Hey y'all, welcome back to Ring of Bell.
Welcome back. Emily's back.
I'm back.
But James is gone.
I know. It's like a revolving door.
I'm the only one here. I'm just like, no, that's true. I wasn't here that one time.
Yeah.
But
great episode.
Coming up, the interview is fantastic.
But also, what you and James did was
great.
Oh,
thank you.
I listened.
Yeah, with Juan Escalante.
Yeah. Super interesting.
Yeah, he's fantastic. You should listen to that episode if you want to hear more about DACA and how to get involved with that. I am sick. I'm not well. So that's, I just want to give an excuse if I sound a little vocally fry.
But he has more of a voice than I did that other week. So that's optimistic.
Yeah, you sounded cool. I just sound sort of pitiful.
It's okay.
Let's get into the news.
He has on his Resist shirt that has Elizabeth Warren on it. So the mind is still there, even though the energy might not be behind the voice.
Lizzie Dubs.
Listeners, don't worry.
Yeah. That's
what he's representing.
That's Elizabeth Warren. She's Lizzie Dubs.
We call her that?
I'm going to call her that. Lizzie Dubs is going to get that dub in 2020. I'm so sick.
220.
Okay. Let's just get Russia. Let's just do it.
220.
I said, I wrote, let's rip the Russia Band-Aid off. Let's just do this. So
this is what I've been trying to do for like 3 months.
We talked last week about Facebook and the campaign ads that were bought by Russia. I said before, I don't want to get too tinfoil hatty, but it is a little odd that the Trump campaign didn't spend any money and then Russia had perfectly targeted campaign ads. And now this week, pressure has been mounting on Facebook to release the campaign ads. And they have been pushing back on that.
They have. Facebook on Tuesday said federal law and ongoing investigations limit what we can share publicly. And I mean, to a certain extent, I hear that, but also to a certain extent, like, can we rip the Band-Aid off? Can we know what happened? Can we see the data? Essentially, after denying for months that any Russian ads had run on its platform, Facebook, the company disclosed last week that it had belatedly identified 470 fake accounts that were tied to a notorious Russian, quote, troll farm in St. Petersburg. The phony accounts purchased more than 3,000 political ads at the cost of at least $100,000 between June 2015 and May 2017.
And this is, just real quick, this is from a Yahoo.com article by Michael Isikoff. So just want to
totally
credit where it's due.
But, I was reading that and I was like, $100,000 is not that much. But of course, they addressed that later in the article saying that the figure, you know, that to purchase that many ads may seem small by the standards of a traditional campaign, but the Daily Beast reported last week that the ads reached at least 23 million users and as many as 70 million.
Mm-hmm.
And also the challenging part of this, or another, you know, thing at play in this situation is that the only entity that knows where and how those ads were distributed is Facebook because of their algorithms and how many people actually saw it and how many impressions it got, which that information is not being released yet. So
well, also, as somebody who has bought Facebook ads for people to come to comedy shows, you can get a lot of people viewing those for like $20.
Yeah. Yeah. So I feel like
come to my show.
So Nick has a show. It's on the east side of Los Angeles called Arts and Crafts Comedy. He's not paying me to say this.
Hey, but thanks. I didn't know that was
going to
happen.
But I do pay an annual friendship fee.
Thank you.
Just kidding.
But
anyways, so
you can get a lot of people with $100,000 on Facebook.
Absolutely. You know, I think it was definitely much closer to that 70 million number, if not higher, since they're not releasing it.
Yeah.
But it was interesting. Also, I saw an article from Business Insider came out yesterday. So that's Saturday, the 16th, titled Mueller Obtains Warrant for Russia-Linked Facebook Ads and Accounts.
It's Mueller. It might be Mueller.
It is Mueller. You're right.
I didn't want to.
I was just reading it really fast.
That's okay.
Thanks.
You went like Bueller with it.
Beamler.
Mueller.
Mueller.
Mueller. Yeah.
We could work out some jokes around that later.
Yeah.
Offline.
You were saying.
Anywho, so he obtained this warrant. And so what's interesting about that, as the associate dean at Yale Law School explained, is that in order to get a search warrant, the prosecutor needs to prove to a judge that there is reason to believe a crime has been committed. Then the prosecutor has to show the information being sought will provide evidence of that crime. And so Mueller would not have sought warning targeting Facebook as a company. Rather, he'd be interested in learning about the specific accounts. So that means that means he already has enough information to know which accounts he wants and wants more data on.
It's showing that if he has reason to believe a crime has been committed.
Yeah.
So that,
and he got the warrant. So
yeah. Right. So it's the Mueller probe. And if that's not clear enough, look at all the Republicans that are like trying to take Mueller down already. So I think that there's a lot of things. They're getting very scared.
Yes.
Then there was another thing. Russia proposed full normalization with the United States under Trump, according to the Kremlin. This is from a CNN article from Eli Watkins and Michelle Kaczynski. And in that they say Russia offered a plan to the United States for a full and immediate move towards normalization or a restoration of diplomatic ties in the opening weeks of President Donald Trump's administration, the Kremlin confirmed Wednesday. And they're getting some of their information off of BuzzFeed. And I understand that you might be quick to be like, oh, BuzzFeed. But BuzzFeed has actually come out with a lot of really good news. And they were the first ones to break the Steele dossier. So that they saw this proposal through BuzzFeed, and the proposal called for the United States to restore all channels, diplomatic, military, and intelligence that had been cut following Russia's invasion of the Ukraine and the intervention in Syria. In the coming months, the proposal called for Russia and the United States to collaborate on information security, Afghanistan, Iran, Ukraine, North Korea, and eventually a full face-to-face meeting between the top national security officials of the top two nations. So, it looks like a move towards sanctions being removed. We don't necessarily have the smoking gun, but I mean, we're talking a full normalization under Trump.
Yep.
After the iciest of relationship under the Obama administration, just suddenly out of the blue. And we have all this information about Russian meddling in the elections. And now we have all this information about Facebook coming out. And we have all this information about these secret meetings that they've had.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't necessarily say suddenly, but it's like, I think maybe it's more just like the cards are falling into place at like magical timing. You know what I mean? It's like we've been seeing these Russia things pile up into this really chaotic pile.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, okay, well, planned.
Yeah.
Probably. But again, no smoking gun yet. No, you know.
We don't know
huge yet. Tipping point yet, the whole thing.
Do you want to move on?
Yeah.
Let's get out of here. Let's get on to the big thing of the week. Unfortunately, healthcare is back on the table. Bernie Sanders earlier this week unveiled his universal healthcare bill. And he said, "We will win this struggle." And this is from an article by Lauren Gambino of The Guardian. In it, she writes, "Battle lines have been drawn as Bernie Sanders launches his latest attempt to establish a healthcare system that covers all 323 million Americans." And Sanders said, "The opposition to this will be extraordinary. They will spend an enormous amount of money fighting us. They will lie about what is in the program. They will frighten the American people." So this is a good thing, I think. Mm-hmm. His new plan. Obviously, there is they say in the article, a concurrent tax raise to pay for something like this. But Americans already pay exorbitant rates for healthcare.
Yep.
And it can only be hijacked and taken higher from insurance companies. And so I think what Bernie is saying is, and he does go on to say, nothing is going to change. There will be probably a tax increase, but your doctor won't change. Your provider won't change. It'll just be a federal government operated.
And I think also in the same article, he says, or they say that he has no illusions about whether it's going to pass in a Republican controlled Congress where, it's essentially not, but he says that the time has arrived to have the debate that he believes is fundamental, which is healthcare a right or a privilege in America? And I think that that's the underlying question to all of this back and forth of Obamacare or ACA or this or that or da 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 da. It's like, we're not going to get anywhere until that question is answered. And so I read this and I was like, yeah, of course, that is going to be more taxes and this is not going to pass. But I think that that's the question in an ideal world, which we're not in, but our Congress
would be talking about.
Yeah. Right. Like let's get an answer to that.
But also let's look at, 15 senators, Democratic senators are co-sponsoring the bill. And among them are Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, Cory Booker, and Al Franken, who are all rumored to be 2020 presidential noms.
Yep.
So this is good. I think this is good. We have to kind of aim a little bit pie in the sky. Right now, when Obamacare happened, the Affordable Care Act, it was a pie in the sky idea. And then we started talking about it.
Yep.
So I think that what Bernie is doing is good. And, you know, the celebration was unfortunately very short because another Obamacare repeal is on the table. And this is so important, and I cannot stress this enough. This has not been talked about a lot. People are trying to be out there on Twitter. You got to get involved. Fivecalls.org,
yep.
50409, text to ResistBot. Send in petitions, sign anything you can, call your representative, call another representative. It doesn't matter right now. All hands need to be on deck because there is another Obamacare repeal.
Yeah. And even though it's only, you know, they essentially only have 15 days or less now because it's
under reconciliation. So,
you know, they only have that much time. Like, you know, stranger things have happened. So again, like Nick said, all hands on deck. Because, you know, let's not give them a chance because now they're close enough to might have a chance, which is...
Right. Well, there's rumors now that they're going to get... They might have the votes. Yep. And this is Bill Cassidy and Lindsey Graham who are co-sponsoring this. And it's not like they... You know, Bill Cassidy has been coming out and saying this week that he doesn't necessarily trust the CBO score. And it does need to be scored by the CBO.
Yep.
And there's not even an indication that it'll get done in time because they only have 15 days. I just think it's like they had 8 years.
Yeah. What makes them think that they're going to present something better in the next 15 days?
Right. And you know, this bill, it doesn't really do anything. I mean, Rand Paul, who wants a full, he wants to take it away, doesn't agree with it. I doubt Susan Collins is going to get on. Mm-hmm. You know, it's maybe Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, John McCain. In Arizona, but who knows, because he's very close with Lindsey Graham, so he might be swayed because of that. Get involved, because even, like, we cannot calm down until it is dead, until this bill is dead.
Exactly. And also, I mean, the same article says that if the GOP doesn't pass this Graham-Cassidy bill, it's extremely unlikely that they'll be able to approve any Obamacare repeal legislation before the midterm elections in 2018. So if we get through this short but challenging 15 days, 2 weeks, etc., you know, there's time for us to shift our focus to those local midterm elections that we, you know, are paying attention to, but right. Maybe on the back burner because hello, healthcare is very important.
Hello, healthcare.
Hello, healthcare.
So moving on, I talked to a friend of mine recently and he was like, we love your podcast, but, you know, it's a bummer sometimes because there's such sad stuff in the nation.
And we're like, well, we can't change the news.
I know, but no,
until you get involved. But I totally hear that.
I agreed with him.
Absolutely.
So we started a new section that we're going to hopefully continue in future podcasts called Get Hopeful. And we want to start profiling candidates that you should know about. And giving you some good news because a lot of bad news. And then we do interview people that should make you hopeful.
Yeah.
So I'm just kidding. But we do interview people at the second half. But during the news section, there are things you should be pumped about. And So that being said, the candidate that I think we're going to talk about this week is Beto O'Rourke.
Texas.
Which is such a cool name. I think his name
is
Robert.
It's such a cool name.
He goes by Beto.
We'll go with Beto.
So Beto O'Rourke is a congressman who's representing the 16th District of Texas. He is 44 years old. He's pro-choice. This is from the Rolling Stone profile that's read that's about him, and you should read it. It's amazing. He's pro-choice. He's a vocal advocate for comprehensive immigration reform. He's fantastic.
He's never lost a race.
He's never lost a race.
Not that doesn't make you a good politician, because great politicians lose races all the time.
Obama,
but I'm just saying,
lost his first.
We know.
Sweet. Sad. Obama.
But he's, I mean, first of all, he's a bassist.
He was a bassist in a punk rock band.
So,
but the thing that got me the most about this profile on him, and it's called Beto O'Rourke, Ted Cruz's Punk Rock Problem, which is such a fun, just great.
It's a great piece.
But he's in a bus going around and he's talking to people. And I think that that's where we kind of lost our way a little bit.
Yep.
There are a lot, and we talked, you know, about the Ta-Nehisi Coates article, which again, if you had a chance to read it, it's monumental. But there are so many reasons why this election might not have gone our way. And I think in general, it is so good to look who your constituents are in the eye and talk to them. If you want to be a representative, if you don't want to be and you don't want to hear people's opinions, that's fine. But if you want to represent people, you should listen to everybody. And Mr. O'Rourke is doing that. He's going, and I was just really struck by that. He's talking to people. And there was a really cute thing in the article who wrote this? Tessa Stewart wrote it for the Rolling Stone. She wrote that after he speaks, O'Rourke hangs around shaking hands and snapping selfies with nearly everyone. And then this woman said, "I'm old enough to remember, and he reminds me of Bobby Kennedy," says a woman in a blue flower print dress. "You can look at him and tell he means what he says."
And also, I think
that's great.
It's great. I love that. And especially from someone who is old enough to remember, because they were there. But also, I think somewhere in the article, I don't remember the exact town, but it, you know, the writer Tessa stopped and was asking, you know, people that were listening to him what they were thinking about, and they were like, "Well, no one ever stops here, you know. They just skip over this town because they assume, you know, they're gonna win or whatever, for whatever reason, or the town is traditionally very small or et cetera." But it's nice to hear that a candidate is taking the time to go to those places that they don't normally, that don't normally get visitors.
I mean, I want
to
see,
get to know the candidate.
Yeah, let's have Democrats in Alabama and Mississippi. There are liberals there. Let's get them coming out, because these are flippable. I mean, Texas is a flippable state.
Absolutely. I mean, it talks about in the article about the urban centers. It might be that article or a different article I was reading, but the urban centers in Texas are becoming increasingly blue on pretty consistent basis.
Yeah. So, but it's good that he's visiting.
Shout out to my sister in Dallas.
So Beto O'Rourke is running for Senate in Texas against
the casual guy that we all know.
Mr. Porn himself, Ted Cruz.
I totally forget his name. Ted Cruz.
Not to shame people for watching porn, but don't deny it, Teddy.
Yeah.
Because we all saw.
We know you're a liar.
I didn't know that there was porn like that on Twitter.
Me neither.
I was shocked at that it happens like that. Anyway.
Anywho, we have a second part.
We have a second piece of good news. This is not a candidate profile, but this is more good news. So.
Yeah. An article written by Daniel Marins in the Huffington Post titled "Democrats Flip State House Seats in Two Districts That Trump Won by Double Digits." It's pretty much the whole article in the title, but specifically, very exciting, Democrats won two GOP-held legislative seats in Oklahoma and New Hampshire on Tuesday, bringing the total number of state legislator seats the party has flipped since the November election to 6. So that's more than zero. Let's focus on the positive.
Well, it's like, it's much more than even Republicans have been doing.
Yep, absolutely. And I think they profiled specifically the Oklahoma election because it was so striking that the Democrat Jacob Rosenkrantz, a school teacher, love that, shout out to the education system, defeated the Republican, a businessman, by nearly 21%, which is huge.
That's huge. Well, and first of all, Daniel Marins wrote this for the Huffington Post. So I'm just always nervous a writer's going to be like, "I wrote that." Like, of course, Daniel, we know.
Daniel, we love your writing.
Yeah, we love your writing.
Daniel, want to come on the pod?
We love your work, Daniel. Damn, Daniel. I'm so sorry. It felt right to say it. Back at it again with the political posts. All right. He also wrote that Democrat Charlie St. Clair, a retired teacher, shout out to the education system,
yep,
defeated Republican Stephen Whaley by 1,267 votes to 1,009 votes. St. Clair, who runs the Laconia Motorcycle Week Association, emphasized his deep roots in the community. He campaigned on improving public safety, maintaining Laconia's nursing home, and upgrading transportation infrastructure. Republican Robert Fisher had won the district handedly in the previous election, but he resigned in May amid revelations that he had founded the misogynist Reddit forum Red Pill. Trump had also won the district in November by 16 percentage points. So we're talking about like a, what, 16 to 17 point swing? More.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
What I love about that, what you just said, that specific section, is that he campaigned on something that everybody can get behind, because that's what politicians are supposed to be doing. Let's campaign on public safety. Nobody wants the public to not be safe. You know, maintaining their nursing home, upgrading their transportation. I mean, it sounds like he was even though he's of the opposite party from the current person in office, like, it sounds like he's focusing on the actual issues and not those party lines, which is so important, especially on the hyper local level.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, get happy. Have a little bit of hope.
Get happy.
Have a little hope, friend who I will not name, that was very honest and we appreciate it.
We do really well with critical feedback.
I know. I'm fine. Jeff Sessions had a sad, sad week. He's a sad, sad boy.
He is very sad.
He's a sad little Keebler elf.
He is
and
sad.
It warms my heart because he's just terrible. He's a terrible person. He's a sad boy. So a judge ruled in a city's favor on Sanctuary City's grants nationwide injunction. This is from the Chicago Tribune, written by Jason Meisner and John Byrne. So, in a ruling with national impact, a federal judge in Chicago on Friday blocked the Trump administration's rules requiring so-called sanctuary cities to cooperate with immigration agents in order to get a public safety grant. The U.S. judge, Harry Leinenweber, held that Chicago has shown a likelihood of success in its arguments that the U.S. Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, exceeded his authority in imposing new standards governing Edward Byrne Memorial Justice Assistant grants across the country. So what's been happening, basically, is the Trump administration has been threatening to withhold city funding. So cities will request funding for various projects, federal funding, and the Trump administration has been threatening to withhold that if they name themselves as a sanctuary city. Boston has named themselves as a sanctuary city. Sanctuary. Wow, I can't get that word out.
I think it's just, it's hard with the city afterwards.
Yeah,
like, I keep trying to say sanctuary city.
Sanctuary. Sanctuary city. Sanctuary city. Okay.
Vocal exercises for next week's pod. Write it down.
But you know, the city of Boston has done this. LA has done this. Chicago has done this. New York has done this, I believe. These are major, major cities, and there's been a threat of withholding funding. And that has now been blocked.
Yeah, I think it's great. It's a huge testament to the big city mayors taking the steps to oppose this insane immigration policy.
Right.
And again, goes back to what we talk about from week to week about pay attention on the local level, because there's, if we have those big city mayors working together on climate change, like there's a mayor, a 40 mayors, something or another campaign online. If we have them working together on issues like this, as far as immigration, you know, it's, even though it's not a direct like line to the president, like having those big city mayors working in the resistance is just as vital, if not more vital, than having allegedly the right person in office.
Yeah, it really does matter. And then this kind of goes back a little bit to the Russia thing, but I thought it fit well into the Jeff Sessions had
it's
a sad week.
It's kind of funny.
Yeah, so
a bit of comedy.
Maggie Haberman.
That's true.
And Michael S. Schmidt of the New York Times wrote an article where they say Trump humiliated Jeff Sessions after the Mueller appointment. So this is from the article. Shortly after learning in May that a special counsel had been appointed to investigate links between his campaign associates in Russia, President Trump berated Attorney General Jeff Sessions in an Oval Office meeting and said he should resign, according to current and former administration officials and others briefed on the matter. Ashen and emotional, Mr. Sessions told the president he would quit and sent a resignation letter to the White House, according to four people who were told details of the meeting. Mr. Sessions would later tell associates that the demeaning way the president addressed him was the most humiliating experience in decades of public life. Wow.
Wow. I read this and I was like expecting it to be an Onion article.
Me
or
too.
Something, because
yeah.
I was like, am I really reading about like high school drama in the
well,
building
was
that is supposed to be running
emotional.
The country? Like, yeah. Just come on.
Mm-hmm.
Like I just, it felt like it wasn't real.
Well, and
I
this
was like,
is
like,
I guy,
can't believe this is news, but I guess I can now that we've been in this administration for X many months, but like, good God in heaven.
I mean,
what
this
the
is
fuck
also
is
a guy
this?
That has built his career off of racial profiling. And like, they even talk about in the New York Times article, how he, his career goal is to like curtail immigration. I mean, he wants to not only,
and I mean, that's the only reason why he decided to stay on.
Exactly.
Sessions is because, you know, he was like, I'm trying to see the bigger vision here,
right.
Whatever the hell.
But I also think it's very, you know, it's very telling that Trump wants to just shit all over his attorney general when he gets Mueller involved. I think that
yeah,
Trump
I mean,
is
he
very
shits
nervous.
All over he who's very close to him.
Right. But I'm know? Just saying that he's there is a clear sign that he is not doing well.
Yeah. I mean, like he doesn't, he's not acting like he's innocent.
No, he certainly is not.
So, you know, anywho,
let's get back to DACA.
Let's do it.
So we talked to Juan last week. And again, get involved with America's Voice. Follow Juan Escalante on Twitter if you want to know more about that. And you know, we talked about this today in the interview too. There is a mental exhaustion that comes with a lot of this stuff. But keep it up. You know, we are in the thick of it right now. And it's very hard and there are so many, you know, balls in the air. But take a rest break if you need to. But then, you know,
jump
follow people
in.
Like Juan and get involved and listen to our interview today. Because there's a lot of work to be done. So,
and again, going back to just our ongoing talk or ongoing like mantra is, you know, figure out the way you can get involved and what works best for you and what you believe in and where you live. But just sitting there and voting is not enough anymore. We all need to take that next step, but let's take the next right step for you.
Yes. Yes, I agree. Okay, let's move on to DACA.
DACA.
So Trump's support for a law to protect Dreamers lifts its chances. So this is from another New York Times article by Cheryl Gay Stolberg and Yumiche Alcindor. And they write, an unexpected meeting of the minds between President Trump and Democratic leaders, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, on Thursday made real a possible deal in Congress to pair enhanced border security with legislation to protect young undocumented immigrants brought to the country as children. One day after Mr. Trump hosted Senator Schumer and Representative Pelosi for dinner at the White House, the president said he could support legislation to protect the young immigrants known as Dreamers from deportation if it were accompanied by a massive border security upgrade. Acceding to a key Democratic demand, Mr. Trump said a package did not need to have funding for a border wall. So, a bit of hope.
Yeah, I mean...
But at the same time, it's very... So it's, you know... The Dreamers are the top priority right now. We're not getting their funding for a wall was not included. That's fantastic. But at the same time, you know, Representative Luis Gutierrez, a Democrat from Illinois, asked, why are we discussing border security? I thought we were discussing DACA. So already you see the slippery slope of the conversation. And I agree.
Yep.
I absolutely agree. I applaud Senator Schumer and Representative Pelosi for doing everything they can. And I don't know what the clean way out is, because even after this was announced, the White House backtracked on it. Trump tried to backtrack on it. Yep. Breitbart called him Amnesty Don. And if there's anything that, you know, Trump doesn't want to lose, it's his base. Yep. So
absolutely.
There are things that are moving in a direction to hopefully protect the Dreamers. And I know that Trump is unpredictable and just a wild old casino man. So we don't really know where he's going to end up. But a couple of days later, on Friday, he tweeted that chain immigration cannot be allowed to be a part of any legislation on immigration. And Tal Copan of CNN wrote, what is chain immigration and how could it disrupt a DACA deal? And the term chain migration, in case anyone saw that tweet, refers to immigrants coming to a country based on a connection to family. In the United States, a small fraction of green cards are given out each year based on employment, with family connections being a much larger share. That includes spouses, children, and some extended family. The demand from Trump could complicate negotiations on the Hill, while there is widespread support for the concept of a DACA deal, most likely paired with border security measures. The details reveal deep divisions between and among the parties that remain steep, and they remain steep hurdles to overcome. So, it's very complicated.
Yeah, I feel like we're very much in a catch-22 coming from like all directions with this particular issue, because on one hand, it's like, okay, cool. Sounds like he's able to, you know, compromise with the Dreamers to a certain extent, but then he's drawing some hard lines as to what is defined as family or who gets green card. It's just like, it's all very chaotic. I think it's something that we all need to keep watching.
I just think it's like whoever's last in the room, you know,
and
I hope
like,
that
totally whoever's last in the room is like got the approval, but right. Then the approval keeps changing and then everyone checks Twitter and now we're all just really confused.
Right. And Twitter
I used
today,
to have a boss like that where it was like, he was a yes man. He would say yes to everybody.
And then
at the end of the day, no one would know what was going on.
Yeah. I just hope that Senator Schumer and Representative Pelosi understand that, you know, we need the Dreamers protected. That is first and foremost.
Yep.
You know, and it sucks that we have to like cut this deal with the devil to have enhanced border security. I hope there's another way around it. But again, get involved. I cannot stress enough. America's Voice, again, 5049 for healthcare. Text that to ResistBot. Get involved with that. Fivecalls.org. Get involved with that.
Yeah. And stick around for our interview. We have Dr. Diane Horvath Cosper and Kelsey Rhodes, both who are involved with the Physicians for Reproductive Health. It's a national advocacy organization. Mm-hmm. So stick around for that. And
yeah,
we rebel.
Take a mental health hour a day if you need to. Look up Beto O'Rourke. Look up the Democrats that are overperforming.
Listen to some good music.
Listen to some good music.
Stay woke.
Listen to some good music.
Get up.
Resist.
Cool. All right. Keep listening, y'all. Thank you so much.
We'll be back. Bye.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Re-Rebel. We're really excited to have on two guests this week, even though we do miss James. But our two guests this week are Dr. Diane Horvath Cosper. She is the medical director at the Whole Woman's Health Clinic in Baltimore and also a member of Physicians for Reproductive Health. And then we also have on Kelsey Rhodes, who's a voice associate at Physicians for Reproductive Health. So thank you both for coming on the podcast from opposite sides of the country.
Of course. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, great. We're so excited to be here.
Great. Well, I'd love to jump in with Diane, perhaps, with giving... It sounds like you live a little bit of a double life as both a daily clinician and also someone who's so involved in advocacy. So I'd love to hear from you about the balance between those things and perhaps exactly what is Physicians for Reproductive Health.
So Physicians for Reproductive Health is a physician-led advocacy organization, and we've got several programs and offer support to physicians who want to be advocates. And so we train people. We have a leadership training academy every year that takes about 40 physicians. And we help people take their passion for patient care and the things that they've learned and their voice as a healthcare provider and as a scientist and as someone who values evidence and be able to take that out into the media, into their communities, into their hospitals and healthcare systems and advocate for good reproductive health policy.
I love the word evidence because I feel like with the media, we're constantly being given opinions and feelings and photoshopped images. But I'd love to hear a little bit more from you about the specific data that you take to the media talking about what Physicians for Reproductive Health addresses.
Yeah, I think that our focus has always been to bring evidence to the public and to the press and to politicians, but to do it with a physician's unique voice. So studies don't mean a lot to lay people without some type of, I think, like interpretation. You know, studies are written for a particular audience, and that's not the people who are watching the evening news. It's, you know, studies are written for other scientists, really. And so one of the things that we help teach physicians to do is be able to take that evidence and make it relatable. And that's I think it's something that it's hard to do, but we can learn it with practice. And I think we've been really successful in helping physicians take both the things that they know from all of the years of school, like the, you know, grade 35 that you finally graduate from when you're in your mid-40s or whatever, and then take that and marry it with stories about the people that we care for and stories about what it's like to provide care in sometimes hostile environments. And I think it really brings that evidence to life and shows the impact of certain policies, the impact of changes in healthcare delivery systems, and what that means for the people that we take care of.
It's interesting too. It's like I think the common theme that we get from a lot of these interviews is that once you put a face to an issue, it's so much easier to get that message across. Like we were interviewing somebody last week, and they were talking about DACA and immigration. And when you sit down, and they did dinners with dreamers, and it's amazing how much sitting with somebody and talking with somebody and learning about their experience kind of it really changes the perspective of people that might not necessarily had that viewpoint before, which I think is kind of amazing.
Yeah, I think it's like things that you can never unhear, right? When you have that, I think we're really privileged as doctors to be let into people's lives in really intimate ways and to be able to share in some of the best and some of the hardest times that people go through. And those stories make an impact. And I carry these patients with me all the time. And I'm always thinking about the things that they tell me. And, obviously respecting patients' confidentiality and their privacy, but also knowing that those stories are really impactful and how to tell them in a way that makes them, come alive to the people we're trying to influence, like policymakers, is one of the things that we at Physicians for Reproductive Health are teaching doctors to do.
It's amazing. I mean, it sounds like we have such an issue here in the United States, and I would assume, globally with health literacy. You know, people get a diagnosis or they get an antibiotic and they generally understand what's happening with their body, but never to the extent of an expert, right? And so it's interesting to hear, you know, you're kind of doing the opposite with Physicians for Reproductive Health. You're training these like highly intelligent, you know, brilliant minds that know about the inner workings of the human body to translate that information back into human speak, you know, so that it can actually be used beyond the four walls of a clinic to a certain degree. And I'd be interested to hear, you mentioned patient privacy. I know that you've spoken out a little bit in the press about, you know, your experience as an abortion provider and, you know, a reproductive health provider, about where is the line in privacy issues related to both you as a physician, but also the patients you're working with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, obviously there's a lot of stigma around abortion and both providing abortion care and getting abortion care. And I think the thing that's going to bust the stigma is for people to continue to talk about it. But I also know that, you know, from my perspective as someone who lives in a big city, you know, I feel pretty insulated and relatively safe to talk about these things. There's a lot of colleagues of mine that don't feel that way. And I think, you know, I can't ask everyone to speak out in the same way, because I realize the stakes are different for everybody. And it's the same with patients. You know, I'm thrilled by campaigns like Shout Your Abortion, where people are talking openly about the impact that abortion has on their lives and the ways that it functions positively, and some of the kind of the, you know, both simple and complicated feelings people have about their abortions or their lack, you know, their inability to get them. But I think it's not right for everybody. And I think we have to be able to, as I think providers, help transmit some of the stories in a confident, you know, in a confidential way or in an anonymous way, that get some of the messages across that our patients, you know, kind of communicate to us without revealing who they are, without compromising their privacy. And I think that there's a way to do that. And that's one of the things that we teach our Leadership Training Academy participants, is how to do that and how to make those stories real for people without compromising the, you know, the integrity of the doctor-patient relationship.
Now, what is the most common thing that you have to deal, like, what's the most common misconception that people have when they first start to learn about this stuff?
Learn about specifically?
Yeah, I mean, just like, you know, abortion clinics and even process you know, what are like the biggest common misconceptions? Because we handle it so differently in the United States. It's like very hush hush and people don't want to talk about it. But again, like we were saying, you know, you put a face, you put a voice to it, and a lot of things become a lot more understandable. And are there a lot of like big ones, or is it just a ton of little things that people have questions about? Because I know that there's always like, there's faith-based stuff that always comes into play. You know, state, there's law stuff that comes into play. So I'm just curious, what is the biggest thing that you tackle kind of almost on a daily basis in terms of misconception?
Yeah, I think, there's so many misconceptions. I think a lot of the people who are campaigning against access to reproductive health care really rely on those misconceptions being perpetuated in order to continue to keep their messages going. What we're trying to do is bring some of the truths about the clinics and about the patients and about the providers out into the open. I think one of the biggest things is this idea that it's, you know, people come in and they're asking if they're weird that they've had an abortion, or they're apologizing for having to be there. And, you know, this is a really normal, normative experience for people to go through. Unplanned pregnancy, unintended pregnancy is so common, and needing an abortion and obtaining abortion care is one of the most common gynecologic services that people in this country obtain. So I think if there's one thing I would want people to take, is that people are having abortions. There are friends and our family and our sisters and our teachers and our employees. It's, you know, at any given day in the clinic, I see people from all walks of life, all ages, from all socioeconomic groups, all races and ethnicities. It's a really common experience that could be a uniting experience. And unfortunately, in a lot of ways, it's very divisive, and I don't think it needs to be.
Absolutely. I mean, I've heard versions of this statistic, but, you know, 1 in 3 women get an abortion, or 60% of women who have abortions are already moms. I mean, we have these numbers, and we're increasingly seeing them out in the public, which is great. But I'd like to circle back to what you said, you know, with them asking in the patient room, like, is it weird that I'm doing this? You know, and what are some of the other kinds of questions you get in that clinic room while you have to build a relationship with this woman so quickly and then go through a personal experience with her? Like, how do you help her along the way in the actual room?
Yeah, it's a really unique situation, because this is not somebody that I'm going to be seeing for the duration of a pregnancy or to care for a long-term problem like you might do in a gynecology clinic. This is somebody, you're right, I go in and I see them and I spend a few minutes with them, and they're placing their trust in me after having only known me for a few minutes. And, you know, when you think about the enormity of that interchange and that relationship you have to build with people in those few minutes, it's really, I mean, it's a gift to be able to do that and to have people, you know, place their trust in you. So that's, you know, I don't ever lose sight of how huge that is, to be able to be allowed into people's lives in this way. But I think one of the things that's worked for me is that I've always worked in clinics where they had amazing staff. And so a lot of the counseling and the trust building and the question asking happens before I even see the patient. So that's been an awesome thing. And I, you know, the staff that we work with are 100% essential to the way that the clinic runs. But I think for me, when I come into the room, I come in with the assumption that this person is the expert on their own life. And I might be the person who knows the most about abortion care in that relationship. And I might be the person who knows how to take care of them from a technical perspective, or what they're likely to experience during the procedure, and can talk them through that. But they're the expert on their own life, and I'm there to serve them, to get them to the place that they need to be.
Wow, that's amazing. I love that phrase, you know, in this context, but in general, like, you are the expert on your own life, and whether that is, you know, specifically with your reproductive health, but across the board, I think that's such a great phrase to take out of this, because everyone should be. So I'd like to hear a little bit more, maybe from Kelsey, about specifically what Physicians for Reproductive Health does, or how it's structured. It sounds like, you know, from what I can tell on the website, you have a web or a network of doctors across the board, across the country, that are working together, going through leadership training, you know. But can you paint us an overarching image of this organization?
Absolutely. So we have a variety of programs that really aim to elevate that physician voice and help them take the experiences that they've had throughout their medical education, and as well as in the patient room, and use those for good. And that's taking those experiences to the media. That's also taking them to their legislators and really sharing how the legislation that's being passed is either helping or hurting the patients that they see every single day. So our goal is to humanize the experience that these patients are having. And in terms of the specific programs that we have, Diane's mentioned our Leadership Training Academy, and we're so proud that over 300 physicians have been through this Leadership Training Academy over the past 10 years. And what this aims to do is give these physicians the tangible skills that they need to practice their advocacy. We also have a program called the Adolescent Reproductive Sexual Health Education Program. And we like to shorten that to RSHEP, because it is a little bit of a mouthful. And what RSHEP does is we aim to really level the playing field in terms of the education that's out there for medical professionals when it comes to adolescent reproductive sexual health.
Wow. It's a mouthful, but I feel like that topic is also quite hard to tackle. So it makes sense that it would be a mouthful.
And I think, I'm curious, I also want to talk to Diane about this, you know, getting the word out. And I read the Washington Post article that you wrote about, you know, fearing for your life and getting the word out and stuff like this. And, you know, what is there a challenge? You know, because in the article, I believe you say that not every abortion provider or every doctor wants to necessarily come out and talk about this stuff. What is the challenge, I guess, when dealing with people that are not necessarily being trained by you guys, but now that are already in the field, like dealing with peers? What is that like in conversations about getting the word out?
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody's got a different kind of view about how they can make the best impact. And certainly, you know, not all of us are media savvy and not all of us are comfortable, you know, writing for a public audience. Not all of us are in a place, like I said, where we feel safe doing that. But I think then for those people who are working in areas that might be a little more hostile, they are really clever and really interested in making an impact in smaller ways that may be a little bit more sly and a little less likely to kind of inflame passions around them. So these are colleagues that have worked to introduce family planning training into the medical curriculum where they teach. They've worked to get a rotation for residents to be able to go someplace and learn abortion care or learn complicated contraception care. You know, they're working to change hospital prescribing policies so that patients can get a whole year's worth of birth control without having to come in for a pap test, which is, of course, not related to birth control in any way, really. And so there's, you know, there's colleagues that are doing research, really important research, which is what we are taking out to the public to, you know, disseminate the information. Not every researcher wants to be out talking about what they do, but the fact that they're doing it is part of advocacy as well. So I think that there's not a one-size-fits-all for how to be involved in this advocacy community. But we have to remember that, like, advocacy doesn't just mean talking to the Washington Post, although that's an important part of it. It also means, you know, advocating to get grants to do this research and, you know, calling insurance companies on behalf of individual patients to try to get better care and better coverage, you know, working with medical students to make sure that they don't get through medical school without learning something about reproductive health care. That's all advocacy, and it's all totally a, you know, necessary part of this equation.
I love that. And I think that's also, that ties into, you know, We Rebel. That's part of our big mission here on this podcast, is to talk to people across the ecosystem, because everyone is an advocate or an activist in their own way. So I'd also be curious to hear specifically with some of your colleagues about how that role changes from state to state. So as you're well versed in this, you know, some states require a 24-hour period to think, or I don't even know how they want to categorize that, before you can go through with having an abortion. And some are closing, you know, clinics because of the size of the hallway and et cetera, et cetera. So how does your role as a provider change from state to state? And then a second part of that question, you know, what advice would you give to women if they're living in a state where it's increasingly challenging to receive this kind of care?
Yeah, I think that it's wildly variable. But the short answer is that the experience of either being a provider or of being a patient is so dependent on these state and local policies and legislation. I think as somebody who practices in Maryland and who has practiced in Washington, D.C. and Minnesota, I have been extraordinarily fortunate to be relatively unencumbered by non-evidence-based policies. So my patients in Maryland, I am able to care for them, you know, based on the best medical evidence. I am able to get them timely care. They don't have these unnecessary, like, non-science-based regulations about waiting periods or about having to view ultrasounds or anything like that. I'm able to provide care to my patients in a way that is in line with medical ethics and with also with evidence-based medicine. So it's a really satisfying place to work. But that said, we get people from Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, Virginia, various other places, and that used to happen in Minnesota as well, where people would drive 8 or 12 hours from several states away because the laws there would just not permit them to get the care that they needed. And as a provider, certainly it's always more satisfying to be able to know that you can walk into a room, offer people options, and then actually carry through a plan. And that's not the case for my colleagues who work in other places. And it can be really frustrating. It can contribute to burnout. It can make people feel like they're always just like pushing that rock up the hill only to see it roll back down again. And it's devastating when you have to turn somebody away because you can't provide care that they need. And I'm seeing that with friends that work in, you know, places like Ohio and Texas and, you know, various other places that have these very restrictive laws that don't improve health, they don't improve safety, they don't improve the quality of medical care overall, they just make it harder to get necessary care. And I'm hearing from friends who have had to turn away patients at the time of their greatest need. And as a provider of healthcare who went into this to help people, there is nothing more devastating than watching somebody leave your office and knowing that you could have helped them, but your state has tied your hands. And so I think that's a huge part of it. And then I don't remember the second part of the question.
No worries. That was a great answer. The second part of the question is, which I'm sure is kind of case by case, but in general, what advice would you give women if they do live in one of those states where it's increasingly challenging to have this care and see it all the way through?
Yeah, it's so hard because no one ever thinks they're going to need an abortion until they need one. And no one ever thinks that they're not going to get their contraceptive prescription covered until it's not covered or until they lose their insurance unexpectedly. So it's hard to, it's almost like this, you know, in a crude way of saying it, it's almost like blaming the victim. Like, these are people who are just trying to get through day to day and take care of their families and go to their jobs and finish their education. And, you know, I think this idea that you don't even think about these policies until you bump up against them because you need something, or you find yourself in a situation where you have an unexpected health problem in a pregnancy and now it's not safe for you to continue the pregnancy. You know, these are real people, and like, they have families and they're trying to get through their day to day. So my overarching advice would be that state and local elections matter, and don't wait until you need these services to think about people who need these services, because it could be you. It could be you tomorrow. It could be you in a few years. It could be somebody that you love. And I think we have run into this situation now where it's like, oh no, wow, this really does make a difference who we elect in the city council, and it does make a difference who gets into the state house in our state. And I think maybe people are more engaged now and seeing, you know, the effect of all of these elections. But I would say get engaged with policies and with voting and with speaking out now, and don't wait until you need the care.
I was going to ask, have you noticed... sorry, were you saying? Sorry.
No, sorry. I just wanted to add a couple things if I could.
Sure.
There are so many local organizations that are out there specifically to support patients that are in need, no matter where you live. And, you know, no matter what, all of this advocacy work that we do at Physicians for Reproductive Health, and I know that Diane does on a daily basis, is we work to ensure that no matter where you live, how old you are, how much you make, where you get your insurance, you know, what your zip code is, that should not decide the access to care that you receive. And so just know, for patients that are facing barriers to accessing the care that they need, that there are so many people out there that do care about you and that are there for you, both at the physician level, but also at the local advocacy organization level.
Yeah, I was curious, because you guys are talking about, you know, organizing and local elections. Have you noticed an uptick in people coming into Physicians for Reproductive Health and people getting involved since this new administration? Because I know that, before, this is an issue that's always been happening in America, but it hasn't quite been at the forefront like it is now. So I was curious, is there an uptick in people getting involved? Because the whole point of this podcast is to get people involved. And when they hear that there are people getting involved, I think sometimes people go with the crowd, which is good for resistance movements.
Yeah, no, that's a really great point. And, you know, we're very fortunate that we have had a strong supporter base since our founding 25 years ago. But we have definitely seen that there's an ability for our supporters to be a little louder now, given the current administration. Mm-hmm. And we really, truly work to give them as many opportunities to speak out as possible. And one way that we're doing that now, and where we have seen a lot of movement, is through a storytelling campaign that we launched on Inauguration Day. It's called Voices of Courage. And what this is a storytelling project where we've been sharing patient and provider stories every single day. We've shared now almost 250 stories. And these are really bringing to life why access to reproductive health care matters. They're not just stories about abortion, while we do see a lot of those submitted, but we also see why access to birth control matters, why insurance coverage of birth control matters. Things just like preventive care that people are accessing at reproductive health clinics like Planned Parenthood and how life-saving that can be, as well as a variety of other forms of reproductive health care. And that's really where we have been completely overwhelmed, just with gratitude for the people that have felt comfortable and inspired to share their stories.
Wow. I mean, that's so great to hear. And so I guess that kind of leads us to our final question is, you know, beyond the traditional sign up for your newsletter, talk to those around you, talk to those family members and those friends that haven't necessarily seen or looked into the whole picture of abortion, but also what you were saying, just reproductive health in general. You know, how can our listeners engage? How can they give their time and money beyond the quote unquote normal ways to engage in this issue?
Sure. So we would absolutely love to hear from listeners and share their stories as a part of this Voices of Courage campaign, because we do plan to continue sharing stories every single day until our reproductive health rights are safe. And so we do need to keep those stories coming in, and your voices are incredibly welcome and needed. And there's an easy way to do that directly from our website, and that's at prh.org. And if you click on Take Action and share your story, you'll be able to submit your story directly online. And besides that, we're always looking for supporters to join our movement. We can be found at PRH Docs, so PRHDOCS, across Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And we're always highlighting different ways that people can get involved, both on a national and state level.
Okay. And I'd just like to add that, you know, if people are wondering what to say, if you feel like maybe you don't have a connection to this, or, you know, you've always been able to access care and, you know, you don't feel comfortable speaking about what it must be like to not be able to get care, if you speak from your own voice, then you won't ever be wrong. And so one of the best kind of stories we hear on our storytelling project is when people are able to get good care, and what does that look like? And, you know, I think we want to be able to not only have in our mind the things that we're fighting against, but what we're fighting for. And I think what we're fighting for is, like, to be able to call your provider and get the care that you need and get it covered by your insurance. And, you know, I think telling those stories can be just as powerful.
Amazing. I love that. And I think that's an excellent thing to end on. You know, what are we fighting for? You know, let's focus on the optimistic outcome. What is the ideal situation for everyone to, like you said earlier, be an expert in their own life and their own, you know, reproductive health? So Diane and Kelsey, thank you both so much for coming on We Rebel. We'd love to stay in touch, and we'll be pushing out all of your information to our listeners, and hopefully some voices of courage might pop up. But thank you both for your time and your expertise, and most of all, you know, your daily work.
Thank you.
It's so important.
Thank you for your work. We really appreciate it.
Great. Well, guys, join us next week. We're going to have a fun interview as always, and we'll talk about the news. You can find us at whatsacreative.com. Search We Rebel, iTunes, We Rebel. Leave us a rating. Say something nice if you want. Find us on Twitter at We Rebel Podcast, We Rebel Podcast at Gmail, and We Rebel on Instagram. We make a lot of fun posts. So cool.
Thanks, y'all.
Bye.
It's a Creative Podcast Network.